From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. On this day, 150 years ago, the Union General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas, to inform those being held as slaves that they were now free. The holiday has come to be known as Juneteenth, a day of commemoration, a solemn remembrance, of celebration. This year, in the midst of protests and police violence, Juneteenth holds special significance. This hour on Point, the hard-fought struggle for freedom on Juneteenth. With us first from Washington this hour, Mary Elliott. She's curator of American slavery at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Mary Elliott, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. Help us understand Juneteenth and exactly what happened on that day in Texas on June 19th, 1865.
Well, on June 19th, 1865, Union Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston, Texas with 2,000 troops. And when he arrived, he announced that freedom had come. Even though technically the people of Texas, enslaved African Americans, were freed by proclamation 2.5 years earlier, it took the Civil War to actually implement that proclamation. And so you see 2.5 years later, the arrival of the Union Army at the westernmost Confederate state. The Emancipation Proclamation freed enslaved African Americans in the rebelling states, and Texas was one of those. And so he read from the General Order Number 3.
And so why did it take so long for the news to reach Texas and those enslaved in Texas?
Well, there is the notion that, in fact, enslavers knew that the Emancipation Proclamation had passed, but they weren't trying to share that news with the enslaved. There's also this notion of the enslaving community wanted to eke out another season of crops. And then there's also the fact that people moved towards Texas in hopes that the Civil War would go in their favor and they could hold on to their human property. But again, the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect January 1st, 1863. And it took the war to actually implement it through all of those states that were refusing to acknowledge that it was a proclamation declaring freedom for enslaved African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, General Granger's announcement in Texas on that day in 1865 made reference to freedom, to the fact that the slaves were free, but it also actually urged slaves to stay with their owners. Right?
Yes. Well, there's some powerful language there. And what's really important is right now everyone's upholding that the importance of freedom, which is true. And it's very important to help listeners understand that, again, there was the Emancipation Proclamation that freed enslaved African Americans in the Confederate states. It took the war to enforce it, but it took the 13th Amendment to end slavery in the nation. Mm-hmm. So here's the language that's important to note. It says that this involves, it says the people of Texas are informed that in accordance with the proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. And it says it involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. The freedmen are advised to remain at their present homes, slave cabins, and work for wages. They are informed that they will not be allowed to collect it. Military post, and this is important, and they will not be supported in idleness, either there or elsewhere.
And what followed after that announcement, those words, was known as the scatter. Former slaves leaving Texas to find family members or to head north, right, for more welcoming accommodations. But boy, it was hard.
Indeed, it was hard. Imagine you're starting off with seemingly nothing. But the fact is, many people left in search of family. Many people left to get away from those who had enslaved them. And they went to manifest their freedom in places they thought would be more likely that they wouldn't face any retribution or anything that would involve further violence or death. But then there are those who stayed. And so, yes, it was a hardship. But you have these that relationship, as I stated, employer and hired labor. And so ultimately, you see the Freedmen's Bureau formed, and the Freedmen's Bureau is supposed to help transition people from slavery to freedom and enforce these fair labor contracts.
Well, we'll get into some of that later. But so that's the official Juneteenth event. What were the early celebrations of Juneteenth like as we're commemorating this day today?
Well, there were celebrations. If you can only imagine some organic moments of elation. But then you see by 1866, there's noted that there was an anniversary of the announcement on that June 19th, the year earlier. And then also in 1867, the Freedmen's Bureau tries to create more of a formal type of celebration. But there are celebrations that's more so grassroots amongst the African-American community. And one of the things I think is very important for people to note is, yes, this has been a celebration that has been carried on traditionally through the African-American community. But what is important about this holiday, about this event, about this celebration and commemoration, is to note that this gives us an opportunity to pause and think about a more inclusive application of freedom in this nation and whether we're living up to these ideals of freedom, justice, and equality.
Let me bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from Durham, North Carolina, Mark Anthony Neal. He is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University, where he specializes in Black popular culture. Mark Anthony Neal, welcome to On Point. How nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So we're commemorating Juneteenth today, the end of slavery in the United States. We've heard Mary Elliott describe what happened. But here we are amid this national reckoning in this country on race in the wake of the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Rayshard Brooks and countless others. Does this year's commemoration resonate with you in a different way?
It feels a little different, if only because there's so much more attention being paid to Juneteenth now. I was struck by some of the conversations in the previous hour, you know, whether the president intentionally, you know, intended to have a rally on this date initially in Tulsa, or he was just simply tone deaf to what the political moment was. The reality is there are probably more white Americans who have become aware of Juneteenth in the last 2 weeks than had been aware of it at any other period of time. And it's not unusual that we have this dynamic where there are everyday practices and ceremonies in Black communities in white America that are largely oblivious to. So it feels different in that way. It also feels different because there's also now a kind of commercial aspect of it that I guess we could have anticipated. But when you consider, you know, so many email and texts that we're getting throughout the day from various business and corporate entities, you know, encouraging us to celebrate Juneteenth and take a moment to catch our breath. You know, it just feels a little different in that way. There's no question that over the last decade or so, Juneteenth has become more important, even within the Black community, particularly for young activists, since there really isn't anything during the calendar year, save Martin Luther King's birthday, that would really signal an opportunity for African Americans, Black Americans to come together to reflect on their moment and to begin to think about, you know, a better way for us to go forward. So it is different in this moment, definitely.
And so how do you, Mark Anthony Neal, how do you personally reflect on that original Juneteenth day? What happened that day?
You know, it's interesting. And listening to Ms. Elliott, you know, a moment ago, you know, Juneteenth really forces us to put ourselves in the mindset of how those folks who literally walked off of these plantations had to imagine what freedom is. And I would argue for the last, you know, more than 100 years, you know, Black scholars, historians, thinkers, philosophers, artists, musicians have been trying to capture what that imagination of freedom might have been at that time. And it's, you know, when you consider that Juneteenth now is a marker of something that happened on a day, but it's also a marker of what hadn't occurred on that day or even going forward. The fact that, you know, 100 years later, we're looking at legislation, Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act, you know, in 64, 65, that essentially tries to guarantee what should have been guaranteed back in 1863. And then, of course, you know, the moment that we celebrate from 1865, you know, speaks to the fact that Juneteenth is a reminder that there is still a gap for Black folks in terms of full citizenship in the United States.
Well, one of the most famous Juneteenths occurred in 1968 when Martin Luther King's widow, Coretta Scott King, decided to cut short the so-called Poor People's March and commemorate it with Juneteenth celebrations. On that day, known as Solidarity Day, she delivered a speech before as many as 100,000 people on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Here it is.
Perhaps racism can be traced to that dark period in our history when slavery became institutionalized for 244 years and segregation was practiced for another 100 years. So you see, the roots of racism are very deep in the psyche of the American white man.
Coretta Scott King went on to say that in that speech that racism deprives black people of their human dignity. Mary Elliott, let me come back to you. How is Juneteenth different for you this year?
For me, Juneteenth, I think what I am most excited about, to tell you the truth, is that, yes, regardless of how people are becoming more familiar with this holiday, that they are. Now, I read that text from the General Order Number 3 because I want people to really think about this psyche of society and the nation, thinking about, okay, so freedom has come, but how were Black people viewed? And how does that reflect on where we are right now? And how we've had to continue to fight for that true meaning of freedom and equality and justice. And so for me, while I think this day is a day of both commemoration and celebration, I want to emphasize that we commemorate and reflect.
Well, and you are from Tulsa, Mary, site of one of the worst outbreaks of racial violence in this country's history, inside of President Trump's rally tomorrow. So I'd like to ask you about that after the break. We're discussing Juneteenth, its history, its significance, and celebrations today with Mary Elliott and Mark Anthony Neal. More after this break, including your calls. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about slavery, emancipation, and what we can learn from our nation's past as we celebrate Juneteenth today. With us, Mary Elliott, curator of American slavery at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, and Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. I want to hear now from Nicole Hannah Jones. She won a Pulitzer Prize last month for her work on the New York Times 1619 project, which reexamined the legacy of slavery in the United States. She appeared on MSNBC earlier this month, shortly after President Trump announced that he would not hold his first public rally since the pandemic on Juneteenth, but instead do it a day later.
It has to have been kind of so egregious that he was going to hold this rally on Juneteenth in Tulsa, the site of this racial massacre, that even Black surrogates who normally defend him pushed back. That tells you how egregious this actually was.
President Trump told the Wall Street Journal yesterday, quote, "I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous. It's actually an important event, an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it." Mark Anthony Neal, President Trump taking credit there for making Juneteenth famous. Your response?
Yeah, he takes credit for a lot of things that he shouldn't. There's no question that, you know, obviously people had heard of Juneteenth before this period of time. And obviously Black folks have been celebrating it now for more than 100 years. But by that same token, you know, his comments also do reflect the fact that there are many white Americans that, because people push back on him choosing that date in Tulsa initially, that the term Juneteenth circulated in the way that it had not circulated in mainstream culture before. And thus, many whites are more aware of Juneteenth because of that. But again, in some ways, that's the way that we've historically centered white knowledge as being the knowledge that's valuable. The things that Black people know are of no value. And so the president would obviously say, you know, for something that Black people know, that in his mind, that, you know, it doesn't matter that simply Black people knew it, that if white folks don't, then, you know, it's now well known.
Mary Elliott, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921, a racist mob killed hundreds of black residents. The president did move his rally back a day out of respect after getting some pressure, a lot of pressure, because of that choice. I'm curious your thoughts, being from Tulsa, your family lost businesses after that riot, no?
They did. And I want to remove myself from talking about the president. I want to put a human face on Tulsa. And my family was enslaved in Mississippi. They got into a confrontation with the Klan and went to Indian Territory, which became the state of Oklahoma in 1907. And it's there where they owned several businesses, including a chain of department stores, the second of which was built in Tulsa. And from a 1918 Tulsa Star article, newspaper article, it had marble, it had chandeliers, it had many things. But most importantly, it was an important business to the community, a community of many people, successful blue collar workers, white collar workers, business owners. And so I am a descendant of those who worked hard to make a life, provide education, build communities. And we lost a business and our family members were impacted by what happened in Tulsa. But understand the people who went to Tulsa, my family was involved in protests in 1875 to enforce the right to vote in Starkville, Mississippi. The strength of these black people continued on when they got to Indian Territory.
Interesting. Well, as we commemorate Juneteenth today, the end of slavery in the United States, Mark Anthony Neal, talking about Juneteenth, you were quoted in The New York Times saying that there are comparisons in this moment on this day between the end of the Civil War and the current unrest that we're experiencing right now. You see this moment as sort of a rupture, your word. Explain that.
Yeah, it feels like there's a rupture, that something has shifted in the national discourse around race. And it really is an aligning of various stars that we could not have expected, you know, even 6 months ago. The fact that so many people were feeling in their own way, going through various trauma because of COVID-19 in ways that they felt concerned about their own citizenship. And this is, of course, race and gender and sexuality and nationality. The fact that when George Floyd is killed is, you know, the national eye and imagination is on this at this moment because so many people were at home. The fact that so many of these young folks could have taken to the streets because they weren't in school, because they weren't doing internships, because they weren't, you know, doing their new jobs. It just created this kind of moment that suddenly we feel the ground moved beyond us, right, below us. And what we don't know what that's going to look like yet. And that's one of the reasons why I make that comparison back to 1865 and Juneteenth. You know, folks got a proclamation that said they were free, but they didn't know what exactly that freedom would look like. And so this feels like that kind of moment now where there's some ambiguity, right, and even anxiety about what going forward is going to look like.
You talk about feeling the ground move beneath us. We saw that even in small, subtle ways today. The food giant Mars saying it's changing the name of the Uncle Ben rice brand. The pancake mix Aunt Jemima announced it will change its name and logo, saying that its origins are rooted in racial stereotypes. You know, these are 100-plus-year-old brand names making big and important shifts in this big and important moment. Mark Anthony Neal, I know you'll say long overdue.
Definitely long overdue. And I think we have to be cautious about this moment. Considering the history we know of slavery in this country and even that important period, you know, between, you know, emancipation to what became another version of freedom, you know, in the 1960s, you know, we can't unwrite the reality of what this history has been in 2 weeks. Because brands have simply chosen to present us with different images or give themselves new names, we can't unwrite the history of trauma and violence and anti-blackness that existed, you know, over this period of time and still exists in this particular moment. And we often have to be honest about the fact that, you know, we now live in a culture because of social media, what we call a cancel culture, that some of the motivation for these companies is the fact that, you know, folks now have the power to cancel them in very powerful ways because of social media. And they have made economic calculations to be on the right side of history to be able to protect their brands, right? Mm-hmm. And so there might be some good-heartedness in this, because that's the thing. You know, this is not the first time, you know, Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben and the Cream of Wheat Man have been targets of criticism for what they represented. You know, Black activists and others have been making these claims for as long as these images have existed. You know, so what has happened in the last 2 weeks that has changed that?
Well, also this week, HBO temporarily, or perhaps not temporarily, shelved the film Gone with the Wind because of its glorification of the antebellum South. You're a professor, Mark Anthony Neal. You've used Gone with the Wind in your curriculum. You're somewhat conflicted about this, speaking about unwriting the history in 2 weeks and really unwriting history generally.
I always find that, particularly from a pedagogical standpoint, you know, whether we're talking Birth of a Nation or Gone with the Wind or any number of cultural artifacts that have been produced, you know, that really focus in on anti-Blackness, they remain valuable tools for us to remember what exactly that history was. And particularly remains valuable because it's also a source of Black resistance to those images, right? When we get rid of those images, we also get rid of that history of Black resistance that, in my mind, is just as important, if not more than important, than noting what they were resisting against. I would argue there's a difference between a Gone with the Wind in the world than people making choices and using stereotypes in order to sell products. I make a distinction here between art and commerce, even though, of course, there's a way in which art bleeds into commerce. So I think we have to make distinctions there. Mm.
Mary Elliott, what about the rising pressure this week, last week, since the George Floyd death, to take down Confederate statues, remove Confederate names from military bases and such? You know, there are some in this country who say that's history. We can't erase our past completely, to which you say what?
Well, it is part of our history. But again, you know, many of these monuments were erected by groups like the Daughters of the Confederacy and to mark the landscape. And by marking that landscape, it marks the landscape with notions of racism and segregation and inequality. And so to change that and remove these from the public arena, but move them into places like museums that will allow more engaged dialogue on the significance of those structures, mm-hmm. how they came into being, the messages that were meant, what it prompted the public, how the public reacted to it, to provide more context, I think that that's very important.
Got a few calls here. Let me get one in here first from Spokane, Washington. Eric is on the line. Hello, Eric. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for your time. I'm 48 years old, and all that's going on in society right now seems to be shining a light on what I didn't realize was such inherently racist thing that were going on around me. Eastern Washington is very white, and I never heard of Juneteenth until recently, and so that's the upside of all this turmoil, is that it's, I think, educating a lot of us that didn't realize what we were living around and sometimes how we act just by how we've been raised in the society that we exist in.
Eric, thank you very much for that thoughtful call. Mark Anthony Neal, there is a lot of education going on for a lot of people who are understanding things in perhaps a new and different way, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's important that suddenly there has been a fora, particularly for Black thinkers, Black historians. The work that Black women historians have been doing in the last decade to provide a different view of the world that we're looking at. I think of the work of someone like my colleague, Thevoya Glimp. I think of the work of Dana Ramey and so many other Black women historians who are trying to put this historical moment in a broader context. And the fact that, again, this way in which educating also connects with commerce, you know, so many of the academic publishers who are pushing out their list and, you know, for folks to be able to read things. And that's one step of the conversation, right? The educational process is the first step of transformation. But again, these are conversations that have been going on for a long time. You know, I chair a Black Studies department here at Duke University that's existed for 50 years. We've been doing the same kind of work for 50 years. Yet there are folks who are just finding out about it now. Mm-hmm. I think what becomes an important step, particularly for white Americans, is that as you're gathering this information, to go to your own folks, you know, to your home, to your communities, to your schools, to your school boards, to your elected officials, to make sure that they understand the dynamic of what's happening here. If not, it becomes the kind of conversation that we've essentially been having, you know, for many decades.
Christina is in Medford, Massachusetts. Hello, Christina. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I just wanted to say have a couple comments. I, first of all, I actually grew up in Texas. I lived there for over 20 years. And so I grew up with Juneteenth as something that was fairly well known and recognized in the communities around me. And as your guest, I believe it was Ms. Elliott, said that it was initially much more of a grassroots celebration. And that's definitely how I experienced it in Texas. And so it's been interesting to see over the past several decades as it has further developed and expanded, and then particularly to see this year how it's really sort of, you know, blown up and is very much on the, you know, in the national spotlight.
Yes, yes.
And additionally, you know, in the past few days, really kind of reflecting more and, you know, thinking more about the comparison to July 4th, Independence Day, and really thinking about, you know, sort of what the distinctions are, and that, you know, Independence Day on July 4th really is an Independence Day for white people more than anyone else. And
July 4th was for white Americans, Juneteenth, the similar Independence Day for Black Americans in this country. I do appreciate your call, Christina. Thank you. Thank you very much. Mary Elliott, that's an interesting observation from our caller there. How do you see it? Do you agree?
I think that both dates are important to all Americans. And I would hate to segregate these holidays, but I understand her point. Because as I mentioned earlier, Juneteenth gives all of us pause to think about a more inclusive meaning and application of freedom in this nation.
Juneteenth,
July 4th, African people of African descent fought in the Revolutionary War. And while they were fighting for their own freedom against a backdrop of a fight for liberty, they still fought. And I think it's important to understand the development of this nation and that African Americans are part of this history all along the way. But it's not a segregated history. Juneteenth should be important to African Americans and all Americans, just like July 4th.
Mark Anthony Neal?
I absolutely agree with that. You know, one of the things I've been saying in the last moment, particularly with so many critiques of white supremacy that have circulated over the last month or so, you know, for many white Americans, you know, the deaths of folks like Breonna Taylor and George Floyd are kind of collateral damage for the safety that they derive from white supremacy. Until they see white supremacy as something that is actually damaging them, until they see what has happened to Black Americans to be intimately connected to the value of their lives, they won't be able to really gravitate to what's important about this moment. And so part of that is that having them understand that the Black American experience is not something that is separate and distinct necessarily from the American experience, that it is, in fact, the American experience. Mm-hmm.
Juneteenth is celebrated around the world, is it not, Mary Elliott? This is not just a holiday in the United States.
It has been picked up in other countries, but what's important to note is that, again, this is something that has been a tradition amongst African Americans, but it is now in, as you mentioned earlier, 47 states acknowledged, including in the District of Columbia. And I know that there is a movement afoot to make it a national holiday. Mm. Yeah.
And the name Juneteenth, where does it come from?
It's a combination of June and the 19th, so Juneteenth, 1865.
I'm curious if either of you have been to celebrations, commemorations in other parts of the world. Mark Anthony Neal?
Only here in the U.S. When I lived outside of Western New York in Buffalo, I often went to Juneteenth celebrations.
Mary?
I haven't been to any outside of the United States, but I would love to go. I know that there's some wonderful ones here in the United States, and we always have Red Punch. barbecue and we watch some rodeos.
Yes,
so it's
ma'am.
All a good time, but a thoughtful time.
We'll talk about some of the food, some of the celebratory food ways that come up on Juneteenth. Coming up next with Michael W. Twitty. We're talking about the lessons from history on Juneteenth as we commemorate this important day in our nation's history. Much more after this break. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're discussing the history, legacy, and hope of Juneteenth this hour. With me, Mary Elliott, curator of American Slavery at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, and also Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Let me bring another voice into the conversation now, Michael W. Twitty. He is a culinary historian and author of the 2017 book, The Cooking Gene, which won the James Beard Award for Best Food Writing Book of the Year. He's also the creator of Afroculinarium, a blog devoted to African American historic foodways and their legacy. Michael Twitty, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
So tell us about the food traditions, Michael, behind Juneteenth. Mary kind of whet our appetite here with the red punch. Give us a sense of what it's all about.
So pretty much the absolute traditional foods that Mary brought up, the red drink, so that can mean just about anything today. It could mean the traditional strawberry soda water, or it could mean hibiscus tea, or it could mean raspberry tea, or it could mean Kool-Aid. It could mean whatever. Watermelon is also important. We have to remember that Texas was way further south and way warmer. So the whole thing about the crops is very important, because if you had waited one more month, you would have gone from cotton chopping time to cotton picking time. Mm. So there was one more crop to be had if there had only been one more month of waiting around. And watermelon would have been seasonal in Texas at that time, whereas other parts of the South, it may have been a month or two later. Mm. Barbecue is very important. You know, we have great tradition of Afro-Texan barbecue. Some of my family was there, our not really distant cousins, but our cousins who were in Texas, in Panola County. My great-great-great-grandfather, who was not black, was in the Texas legislature. Hmm. But his son was definitely there, alive and well, when the first Juneteenth landed.
Wow.
Well, the other part of my family, my great-great-grandfather in Virginia saw the surrender with his brother.
Wow.
So they were there when it was official that there was no more slavery.
Hmm.
So this tradition of red food is very interesting, and people have asked me, where does it come from? And like a lot of things in African-American folk culture, you're hard-pressed to get one answer, partly because there's this beautiful word in we have in English that in Yoruba is called awo, and awo means mystery. So some things are meant to be mysteries as to hide the true power behind them. Hmm. And the Texans, Galveston's very important because Texas had one of the largest, it was a very small group, but the largest population of people on the 1870 census that could say that they or their parents were born in Africa. That was 3%.
Hmm.
of the Texas population on when the Civil War ended could say, I was born in Africa or my parents were born in Africa. And that was because Texas was at the end of the line, right? So 1845 becomes a state. And for all that time between Southerners pouring in and it being part of Mexico, then being its own republic, there were slave ships coming in through Galveston from Cuba and other places and from West Africa. And long after the United States Eastern Seaboard had outlawed constitutionally the slave trade. So a lot of people are being brought in to Cuba from the Congo and the Yoruba cultures, both of which have a very interesting relationship with color and spirituality. Mm. So we talk about red, it could mean anything from sacrifice, like blood sacrifice, called Igbo in Yoruba culture, or it could mean resistance and power, the Orisha Ogun of war. Remember that war just happened. Mm. Or it can mean transformation. All those things kind of fit, right? So that's where that comes from.
Yeah, the color of fire, the color of war, the color of resistance, the color of perseverance. It does cover a lot of things.
Ashe, creativity.
Ah, yes. Michael, you write that studying the food of the past doesn't just uncover what people used to eat. It reveals the stories they wanted to tell. Is there a particular story that you would share that illustrates that from Juneteenth commemorations of years past?
I just kind of look at it this way. Why there's this line from Alice Walker's The Color Purple. I'm going to paraphrase it, and it's sort of related to this. It was the book ends with them eating barbecue and talking about July 4th. And they have the questions asked, why do white people celebrate July 4th? Because they got their freedom. Well, we didn't have freedom. And someone says, that's right. That's why on these days, black people celebrate each other. And I think that's a glorious part of this we need to recognize. The parades are there and the rodeos and the quilting bees and all those traditions and the barbecues. But this is really about black joy. This is about the hidden black joy behind black food. I mean, so often we hear black food talked about in terms of being a pathology, a problem, yet another problem of those black folks. But the reality is our food is a form of joy and love that we express to each other and also to the world.
So as a culinary historian, what's on your menu this year? How are you personally celebrating Juneteenth?
Well, it's also Shabbat, so I have to plan for that. So jollof rice, definitely like one of my favorites. Barbecue chicken, definitely. I'm trying to make my chef brother, Chef Omar Tate's homemade Kool-Aid with the dehydrated fruit and citric acid. It's like, do it yourself. So, you know, just playing around watermelon and feta salad, you know, having fun with all these different things. I started the morning with a strawberry oatmeal, if that counts.
Ah, very good. Well, thank you so much, Michael Twitty. We really appreciate hearing the history of the food. The culinary history is so important, too. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Let's go to the phones. Jereen is in Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Jereen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I bring you greetings from the original Confederacy, that of the Chickasaw, the Chickahominy, the Pamunkey, the Powhatan Confederacy. I have been very privileged to be part of an amazing Juneteenth celebration, and I invite all of you to come to Virginia to experience it sometime when you're able, because, of course, it all started here in Virginia.
I love it. Jereen, what are your traditions? What are your rituals?
We gather in the afternoon for cultural celebrations, music and poetry and drumming. And at sunset, we gather at the place that's called Ann Carroll's Landing, which is where the original ocean-going vessels that came from West Africa and from the Caribbean to bring those captives here into Virginia to be sold into slavery. So we start where those first African feet first touched the ground, and we walk in their path where they were unloaded at night so as not to offend those who lived on the hills above who profited from this tragic commerce. And they would be walked at night along the path to the holding pens through the whole industrial area of slavery in Richmond, Virginia. We pass through that area and we end our evening's walk by candlelight, by torchlight, in the original African burying ground here in Richmond, Virginia. So this tradition has been going on and produced by the Igbo Folklore Society for nearly 20 years, I believe. Wow. I've also been fortunate to be part of a sunrise celebration for Juneteenth on the Sunday closest to Juneteenth in Miami, Florida. We would have a sunrise gathering on the beach and make prayers. We would build a raft from coconut fronds, and people would bring gifts of fruits and vegetables and the harvest and put those onto the rafts and walk them out into the water to tribute as a tribute to those who perished in the Maiafa. So I encourage you all to come here to Virginia and experience. It's a very moving and healing experience, and I'm so grateful that I've been able to share it with my children and anyone who is interested in really working towards healing the wounds of this nation. I invite you to come and be a part of it here in Richmond.
Jerene, thank you. Thank you very, very much. I do appreciate it, and I'm grateful for you sharing that and for your vulnerability and for the emotion attached to it. I thank you. Mary Elliott, your thoughts?
I think it's powerful, her statement, and it's important to see how this moment, you know, between the history we've discussed, Michael discussing, you know, the importance of the different cultural traditions, this young lady talking about how it's a moment of reconciliation, healing to think. And then, you know, our professor from Duke discussing how this relates to today. I think it's all very important. And as someone who I've shared with you, my history being from Tulsa, and in fact, my mother's family is from Houston, Texas. This has a very personal impact on, it has an impact on me. And I appreciate people like yourself who are providing these forums for all of us to be engaged in these important discussions, because this is a very transformative moment in our history.
Jerene is in Virginia, so I wanted to play this clip. Pharrell Williams, the Grammy Award-winning musician, is also a Virginia native, helped announce a proposal to officially make Juneteenth a state holiday in Virginia. Here he is.
This is a big display of progress, and I'm grateful for Virginia and us leading the way. From this moment on, when you look up, you look at the vastness of the night sky, and you see those stars moving up there. Know that those stars are our African ancestors dancing. They're dancing in celebration because their lives are finally being acknowledged. And I can't say it too many times up here today, a paid holiday. It's not the end of it. It's merely just the beginning.
Mark Anthony Neal, in 1979 that Texas became the first state to make Juneteenth an official holiday. Now 47 states recognize Juneteenth as a state holiday. Where do we stand in the process of making Juneteenth a national holiday?
There clearly is an uptick now of many people who are pushing for the idea of a national holiday. We've seen it amongst journalists over the last few years and, of course, activists. And there's no question that, you know, the acknowledgement of a national holiday would allow us to have that day where we can kind of reflect on the importance of this moment. But we also know that, you know, our celebration of holidays here in the United States are fraught with all kinds of contradictions. Every year we celebrate Labor Day, but we're not really celebrating the history of labor in this country. When we celebrate Labor Day, it's a great day for a cookout and a barbecue, depending on your community. You know, I grew up in New York City and am old enough to remember where we used to celebrate, you know, Abraham Lincoln's February 12th birthday, separate from George Washington's birthday. Most kids have grown up now in an era where they know a President's Day, and they couldn't actually tell you the days of either president's actual birthday.
That's right.
At this point in time. And of course, we have MLK, which is probably the one holiday that resonates for many people in this country that have this conversation about race. But of course, our conversation about race is much deeper than what Martin Luther King represented in a particular historical moment.
So, Mark Anthony Neal, in this moment, as you look at the at so many things, the racially disparate impact of the coronavirus, as an example, the impact of police violence. In this moment, on this day, on Juneteenth, what do you want people to know? What do you want our listeners to know about what's really important on this particular day?
You know, when I think about that last caller and the emotions that we heard, we can't simply treat this as a drive-by moment where everyone feels good about the fact that we're having some sort of conversation about race. This should be a grounding point, you know, for us to begin to have really substantive questions around policy and change and how we do things in this country that makes sure that this country is much more equitable. We've known historically that the struggles of African Americans, of Black Americans, their desire to achieve some semblance of freedom, to have some sort of input in the process of citizenship in this country has often moved the needle in terms of the society becoming much more equitable. And this is just another occasion for us to begin to do that real serious and important work.
Mary Elliott, on this day, on Juneteenth, what do you want our listeners to know?
I want people to take a moment and really pause and reflect on the words of that General Order Number 3. To understand the significance of kinship, communities, and family to African Americans and all Americans, and why this moment is both of commemoration and celebration. And I need to say this, there are protests out in the street right now, and it is a buildup of so many things. But we're in the midst of a pandemic, and people have taken their short term, their lives in their hands to prevent death in the long term. But when we open back up, and we have to be face-to-face in those office buildings, in those meetings. Think about death by a thousand cuts, microaggressions, implicit bias, and blatant racism. And we need to have a serious conversation about race in this nation and how we can change the way that we move forward.
Michael Anthony Neal, in our last minute here, how will you commemorate, how will you celebrate personally Juneteenth today, you and your family?
Well, I'm about to have an event, participate in an event with my fraternity, Phi Beta Sigma Incorporated, in which we'll sit down and reflect and think about Juneteenth as we'll be as a group reading Sandy Darity and Kirsten Mullen's great new book on Black reparations.
Mary Elliott, how will you celebrate, commemorate today?
I am going to take time out to appreciate my family, call my mother in Houston, Texas, read a few good books from some of these dynamic scholars like Dr. Neal, and just kind of pause for a moment.
It's a good opportunity for all of us to pause, to think about this incredible pace of change and the shift that we have seen just over the last couple of weeks, and to remember the history behind it. Mary Elliott, curator of the American Slavery Project at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Mary, so great to have you today. Thank you for your insights and your perspective.
Thank you.
Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Professor, thank you very, very much. How nice to have you.
Thank you.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook. We're there at On Point Radio. I hope you have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.